You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
Hey guys, and welcome to episode 366 of the podcast. And this one, I got back on Dr. Michael Greenberg. And as you can tell, my sore throat has stuck around, although I think it's getting better, so hopefully my voice will be back to normal soon. But for those of you who aren't aware of Michael, Michael is a clinical psychologist, and he specializes in rumination-focused ERP. In this episode, we discuss integrating psychoanalytical and behavioral perspectives, OCD and attachment theory, the fear of losing attachment, Mallon's model of OCD, unacknowledged normal healthy feelings. We both share a couple examples from our own lives, healthy aggression, and at the end we talk about rumination. And thank you to our new podcast partner, JS Health Vitamins. JS Health is an Australian wellness brand. Jessica Seppel is a nutritionist and founder behind JS Health, and also a dedicated listener to the OCD Stories podcast. In fact, she says it changed her life, and she found her therapist through our podcast, which she's been seeing for almost 3 years. Jess has always been very open about her mental health journey, including anxiety and puro OCD, and is passionate about opening up this conversation and supporting her community to feel healthy, happy, and confident. This level of care that Jess has is really what sets JS Health Vitamins apart. Their range of vitamin formulas are solution-focused, meaning they are designed to target your main health concerns and support a whole range of wellness goals. Created using some of the highest quality ingredients, backed by science at a therapeutic dose, that's what they are known for, verified by tens of thousands of real customers all around the world. Whatever your needs are, think skin health, gut health, hair growth, sleep support, more energy, or even a libido boost. JS Health Vitamins have a formula for that. Along with their best-selling supplements such as Hair Plus Energy, Skin Plus Digestion, and Detox Plus Debloat. They also have a marine collagen collection, topical vitamin skincare and hair care ranges, plant-based protein powders, and more. Jess has carefully formulated every single product to care for her customers. And they are always GF and GMO free, made of ingredients you can trust to high Australian standards. They have given me an exclusive discount code for you all. Head to jshealthvitamins.com and use the code OCDSTORIES at checkout for a generous 15% off the entire range. You can also head to the show notes for all the info, including the discount code. So thank you to Jessica and JS Health for supporting the show.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description.
So thank you so much to Michael for his time. I really appreciate it. And to you guys, as always, thanks a lot. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. You, of course, have released a ton of new articles since we last spoke. So it'd be good to delve into some of those, three times now. So, I wanted to start off by, you've changed your, subheading, I guess, under your name on your website. So it now reads, specialized cognitive behavioral and psychoanalytic treatment for OCD. So that's quite a bold statement. So why the change?
I've been learning more about psychoanalysis, and just for anybody listening who doesn't know, like, I'm using the terms psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic and psychodynamic interchangeably. There are people who use them in different ways, but you can also use, I'm using them interchangeably. Fine. So I've been learning more about psychoanalytic perspectives over the past few years. I've been in analysis for, I think, about 4 years. And I did coursework at the Institute here. And as I've learned more and more, it's become a bigger part of how I see things and how I understand therapy and OCD. And so it came to be such a big part of it that it no longer felt accurate to just say that I was cognitive behavioral, even though I'm also clearly cognitive behavioral and I do ERP, it was just more accurate to say that I was both, because I really do integrate both at this point. Writing the psychoanalytic articles or the articles that integrate psychoanalytic perspective for the website took a very, very long time. These are ideas that took time to formulate, but then also I had to write them in a way that would be like helpful and comprehensible to the CBT community. And so those articles, I mean, there are more in the pipeline, but just that like suite of articles was the product of years. And so there was this period of time when I was working on them, but they weren't quite ready yet or ready to be shared publicly. That there was this discrepancy between this website that was purely cognitive behavioral and like what I actually thought. The point is I wanted to have those articles on the website to explain that my perspective has broadened a lot. At the same time as I was like coming out as psychoanalytic, as it were.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. And obviously it's more open and honest from a marketing point of view, because if people start working with you or any of your therapists and then they're like, well, why are you bringing in some psychodynamic concepts? You put that up front.
Yeah. I mean, we've been ever since, it's still correct. Whatever. Yes, that's true. We're not a psychoanalytic practice. We're a cognitive behavioral. We do CBT in the context of a psychoanalytic perspective on what's going on. I guess we should like define what in the world we're talking about. People think that psychoanalysis is like weird, like hidden sexual stuff. And really, I think that a more accurate way of thinking about psychoanalysis is that it's about a person's emotional experiences in the context of their relationship experiences. Rather than being, I think the stereotype of analysis or psychoanalytic theory is that it's very heady, intellectualized stuff that really is thinking as opposed to feeling. That's really not what psychoanalysis is about. Again, in contrast to even what I expected, it's really about a very individually focused, personal, subjective experience of one's feelings, feelings that one has trouble with, feelings that one feels guilty about, feelings that one can't acknowledge, and the relational context for those feelings and what can and can't be acknowledged. So basically, it's not exclusive to ERP. ERP means you're doing something, you're intervening on the level of thoughts and behaviors. And psychoanalysis just adds this whole extra dimension of like, what's really going on here? Why is this person having these experiences? I'll give a couple of examples. And for anyone who's listened to me talk about this in other contexts, they've heard these examples before because they're my go-to. So with apologies for that. If we have, let's say we have someone who has intrusive thoughts of harming their baby. So on a cognitive behavioral level, you could, you know, do exposure, you could look at their feared consequences and whether they're realistic, you could give them psychoeducation about OCD or et cetera. But then what a psychoanalytic perspective might add is that perhaps this is a person who has trouble acknowledging angry feelings towards somebody they love, not unhealthy angry feelings, normal angry feelings. And maybe this is a person who came from a home where it wasn't okay for some reason to feel angry with someone you loved, whether that was because their parent was too fragile for that, whether that was because their parent reacted badly to that, whatever it might have been. And so the unacceptability of those normal and healthy feelings might be the context for these intrusive thoughts, as it were, or I would more correctly say preoccupation with the idea of hurting their kid. And so understanding the context for that allows you to intervene on that level and to be able to look at those feelings, be able to acknowledge those feelings, understand that those feelings are normal and why they feel so unacceptable to this person. And none of that is exclusive to working on a cognitive behavioral level. It just also addresses things at a deeper emotional relational level.
Hmm. Yeah, really good point. And definitely going to ask you more questions about healthy aggression later, which is what you're alluding to there, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing that sticks out in my mind is, you know, when I've asked therapists before, you know, why work with OCD? And they'll often say it's fascinating, or the people are just very nice, you know, who are affected by OCD. Mm-hmm. I see that in my clients. They're always usually very nice people.
Everybody gets their aggression across one way or another. So yes. It's going to come out somewhere, but
exactly that. But in conversation, they come across as very nice, very sensitive people, which makes you think, well, as you're saying here, are they not owning maybe some darker thoughts and feelings that were just unacceptable to them, which are perfectly normal. When I say darker, that was a bad word. But,
maybe this is a good opportunity to get ahead of people's concerns about what we're saying. Yes, you know, yes. When we're talking about darker feelings, we're talking, people think that psychoanalysis is like exposing something ugly. Like, oh, or specifically people with OCD listening to this and who are afraid of psychoanalysis are going to think that it's saying you really are a pedophile, you really are a murderer, and it's not saying any of those things. We're talking about healthy, natural, normal feelings, like being angry with somebody you love, like normal being able to acknowledge your needs and wants, like feeling ambivalent about someone, feeling disappointed in someone. Setting boundaries, normal and healthy feelings and needs that for whatever reason are conflicted or unacceptable for the person, and then get expressed symbolically in these symptoms that are, you know, obsessions about X, Y, or Z. So when we're talking about people not acknowledging their feelings, or something being unconscious, we're not talking about something, you know, horrible and shocking or what the person is obsessed with. That's not unconscious. That's what they're thinking about. Unconscious means that there might be a normal, healthy feeling here that the person doesn't even realize they're not acknowledging, because that's the whole nature of what's going on. And that's what we're talking about. Do you think that that's sufficiently clarified for listeners?
Yeah, for me, but I think, I'll give myself as a case study. So my theory for many years has been, as a young kid, my parents were really good, but the communication wasn't there verbally. No one could really share emotions in any serious way. So I feel, and there are other things going on that I won't share, but there was, I think there was a lot of anger that I just couldn't express or didn't feel safe to express or didn't even know how to express. So I feel that maybe then manifested or triggered at least the OCD symptoms. So, and my themes changed and waxed and waned over the years, all different kinds of themes, which shows you it's not really about the themes, which is every CBT therapist will say, and we're still saying that, but they were just a byproduct of maybe some feelings I wasn't willing to own yet, which now I have owned. And I'm not saying that it immediately took away the OCD, but I think it's definitely helped me emotionally.
Yeah. I mean, I'll share about myself a little bit. There's a principle in psychoanalysis called multi-determinism, which means it's not one thing. Like, you can't say this symptom is a consequence of one thing, but like you're saying, there are these sort of broad strokes and main factors that we can still identify. So with that being said, I grew up with a mom who had cancer my whole life from when I was very little, like as far back as I can remember. And so how could you have like aggressive feelings or even needs or wants, or be angry with someone who you were really actively afraid was going to die? And there were other factors also in terms of, you know, how different feelings were managed in different relationships in my family. So as you're alluding to, it's not one thing. But that's sort of along the same lines. And I think that if you look at, I was recently talking about this with some people in my practice. If you look at people with OCD, there's usually something that sensitized us to the prospect of losing attachment. There's something that made the possibility of losing a person or losing love real to us. And so we weren't people who just walk through the world thinking that's fine. Like, you know, that doesn't really happen. We're people who had an experience that showed us that no, loss of attachment is real. Loss of attachment is something that could really happen. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a broad stroke for everyone in my experience.
Yeah, it's a good point. Like, I have a clear memory in my mind when I think I was like nine-ish, around the age of nine. And it was the first time I clocked on, like, this can't be what everyone experiences, what the OCD, this has to be, mm-hmm. something's wrong here. Yeah. And I felt, okay, I need to tell my parents. I didn't, because the clear thought in my head was, if I tell my parents, I'll be locked up in a straitjacket, which was my view of mental health at the time. I'll be locked away and I'll never see them again, which of course is a fear of loss of attachment. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to lose. It wasn't that they were going to shame me. It was that I wouldn't see them again because I would be taken away.
I think that's in line with for anybody who knows my work knows that many years ago, a few years ago, I published an article on the core fear. And in my experience, usually the core fear is about a loss of attachment in one way or another. There's an article, if anybody who wants more nuance to this, there's an article in the suite of articles that I just put up that talks about a little more nuance on whether the core fear is always loss of attachment. So I don't need to go into that here. But broadly speaking, I think that in the background of every case of OCD is, on some level, a fear of losing attachment to other people, whether that is losing a specific person, that's very individual. It doesn't have to be, shame would be an example of loss of attachment, being shamed and like a social pariah, excluded from society or from your family. Or it could be, you know, being sent to a hospital, being, you know, excluded from your family, not being taken care of, not being loved. It looks different for different people, but all of these are variations on the theme of loss of attachment.
Yeah. Which, if we just boil it back to being a baby, our survival depends on attachment.
I would say also just even as adults, I think anybody who doesn't understand how terrifying and painful the prospect of not having attachment is just someone who has never faced that possibility. We talk about food security and food insecurity. And like, you know, if you grow up and there's always food and there's never a possibility of not having enough food, it's not something you think about at all. You take for granted, truly take for granted that there's always enough food. And if you grow up not having enough food or facing the possibility of not having enough food, then you don't have that assumption. And I think the same thing applies to attachment. If you grow up and there are just tons of people who take care of you and love you and validate your feelings and, you know, make you feel like not alone, then you take that for granted that that's just how the world is. And there are always people who love you and will take care of you. And if you grow up without that, you have a very different experience of the world. I work with borderline as well as OCD. And the way that I think about borderline dynamics, not just the way I think about them, I also, you know, my clinical supervisor is in the background here. These are people who had like terrible attachments or attachments that were totally unstable or, to use my supervisor's word, tortured, you know? And I don't think their reactions to that are different from what anybody else's would be. Their situation is different. And I think a lot of the work there is building a secure attachment and then, you know, going from there. So anyway, that's a sidebar,
it's useful. And I guess what also came to my head is, at least in the UK in recent years, there's been lots of talk and lots of press around how loneliness is really bad for your health.
It's like anybody who's ever felt alone or feared being alone is like, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We were born to be connected. Okay. So I'm glad the attachment came up early. Malin, who is Malin and what was his model? I guess, and I'm asking you this because he features heavily in one of your articles.
Okay, Malin was a psychiatrist in the middle of the last century at the Tavistock, which those in the UK know what the Tavistock is. Those outside of the UK, the Tavistock is a hospital in London.
Yep.
That is like the one of, or if not the center of psychoanalytic thinking in the world. Is that accurate to say?
The Tavistock? Yeah, I would argue after Freud and all of that, it became the epicenter. Yeah. At least in England, yeah. But John Bowlby was there, obviously the father of attachment theory, and everyone was there,
right? Yeah. So Malin was a psychiatrist there. He published several books. One of them is called Individual Psychotherapy and Science of Psychodynamics. As a sort of background, I don't know, should I be like leaving out the background?
No, go for it.
Okay. So I basically, my path to psychoanalysis was like this. I worked with Elna Yadin. I trained with Elna Yadin. She has this idea of the core fear. I started applying this to patients. So I started noticing that the core fear was really an experience of emotional pain that a person was terrified of experiencing. And so this idea of avoiding a feeling reminded me of a book called Affect Phobia that I studied on internship, which is about psychodynamic theory. And in there, there's Malin's triangle of conflict. So then I went back to Malin and read Malin. And then that was the beginning of my becoming psychoanalytic. So everything flowed from there. So basically, the key concept in Malin is the idea, he came up with a really simple model for psychodynamic formulation. In other words, for thinking about mental health issues or symptoms from a psychodynamic, psychoanalytic perspective. And basically it goes like this. In any given situation, we have how we naturally feel about something or how we naturally would feel about something, whatever that might be. Maybe I would naturally feel angry. Maybe I would naturally feel grief. Maybe I would naturally feel helpless. Maybe I would naturally feel disappointed or whatever it might be. Okay, feelings. And then if there is sometimes a natural feeling will pose a threat to attachment. Okay, in other words, feeling the way I'm feeling will result in a loss of love, basically. So let's say, using a couple of examples, let's just, for the sake of an example, let me use something extreme. Let's say I have a narcissistic parent, and if I feel anything critical towards them, they radically like devalue me and reject me. Okay. So then feeling how I really feel about them in a certain moment where I feel disappointed or I see something about them that's not ideal, that could result in a loss of attachment. Right, not necessarily permanently, but a terrifying loss of love from them in that moment. Or let's say if I set a boundary, I get attacked for it. Or I get shamed, I get told that I'm, you know, selfish and ungrateful or whatever it might be. Okay, those are two good examples. So, okay, basically we're saying there's a natural feeling that could be threatening for some reason because it poses a threat to attachment. And then because I can't acknowledge that feeling because it poses a threat to attachment, but that feeling still needs to be expressed in some way, it gets expressed in a way that gives it expression while also disguising it enough to avoid the consequence that I'm afraid of. A good example of this is passive aggression. Let's say I'm angry, but if I get angry, somebody would shame me or invalidate me or attack me for my anger or retaliate, who knows, whatever. So then what I might do instead is be, not on purpose, but unconsciously, I might be passive aggressive. And so that might give expression to my anger while also not leading to the consequence that I'm afraid of. Okay, so that's Malin's triangle of conflict. There are three points on it: the natural feeling or the hidden feeling, the painful emotional consequence, and then the defense or the symptom, which is the same thing, which gives expression to the natural feeling while avoiding the painful emotional consequence. And so flipping this around, it means that behind every symptom in psychopathology, somebody told me that the word psychopathology was triggering for them recently. So let me clarify this. Psychopathology is just a fancy word for a mental health problem. Yep. Depression is a psychopathology, OCD, anxiety, they're psychopathologies. It doesn't mean like schizophrenia. Okay. So what this means is that behind every psychopathology is a natural, healthy, normal feeling that can't be acknowledged or felt for some reason. And so part of, in broad strokes, the one way that psychoanalysis or psychodynamic therapy works is by being able to acknowledge and feel the feelings that are not being felt, and thus like alleviating the symptoms or the defenses against those feelings. Does that, for anybody who wants, my clearest version of this is in the article. So if anybody's like, what are you talking about? I did my best and clearest version in the article that's on the website.
No, I think you're being pretty clear, but equally, it's, if it's the first time you're hearing this, it could easily be very confusing. So, but I think you're being clear, and I will link to the article anyway.
Yeah.
So people will have it.
Should we give an example from OCD?
Yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah. So Mallon's model of OCD specifically is that he talks about, basically, there are two needs in relationships. We have the need to be attached that we talked about. We have to be loved and connected with other people. And then we also need to protect ourselves and get our individual needs met. Okay. This, that category is what Mallon would call healthy aggression. Okay. It doesn't mean being aggressive, like being a jerk. It means healthy aggression, like setting boundaries, saying no, asking for your individual needs to be met, expressing anger, expressing criticism, like the things that connect us to other people, and then the things that protect ourselves. So from Mallon's perspective, and I am simplifying a little bit, in OCD, what we have is a conflict between healthy aggression of some sort and attachment. So feeling my healthy aggressive feelings would pose a threat to attachment. And so because I can't feel or acknowledge those feelings, they get expressed symbolically in these OCD symptoms. So for example, you know, we used the example before of somebody having being preoccupied with whether they're going to kill their baby or ruminating about whether they're going to kill their baby. So maybe this is a parent who feels like it's unacceptable to feel angry or hateful feelings towards a baby, which Winnicott, who's a very famous analytic figure, wrote a paper in which he lists all the reasons for a mother to hate their child. Okay. So let's take for granted that it's normal to have those feelings towards people you love. So let's say, putting this in Mallon's terms, so a person has natural angry feelings towards the baby, right? Like, ugh, why are you crying now? Or like, ugh, I just want to like throw you out the window. Normal. And then they're terrified. They're like, oh my God, like what does that say about me? Or like, I can't feel that or whatever. And again, there's a history here for them of, in their experience in relationships, it was threatening or unacceptable to feel such things or to acknowledge such feelings. And so the symptom of being preoccupied with hurting the baby is actually a defense against normal and healthy feelings. And you can think about how that works in many ways. First of all, it moves them away from their feelings and into their head. So now they're thinking instead of feeling. And I mean, whatever, you can think about how it, I don't want to get into how a defense operates, because that's not something that I profess to be an expert in, and also is definitely beyond the scope. But the point is that the symptom, even though it's distressing, it is actually defending against a more threatening, painful feeling.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for mentioning Winnicott, who I believe is Tavistock as well.
I think everybody yeah. is Tavistock.
Yeah. Yeah, and Winnicott came out with a good enough mother. That's what he talked about, and that gets thrown around a lot. I like the example you gave of the parent or the mother or the father who finds it unacceptable to be mad at their baby or their toddler. And as a parent, I can say they push you to your absolute edge. And you combine that with sleep deprivation and no time to do your hobbies and stuff, you're naturally going to be angry at your kids sometimes.
Yeah. It's always striking to me that you hear like healthy parents say exactly the same things as parents with OCD. Like, I just want to put them in the microwave, or I just want to throw them out the window. Except the healthy the person without OCD says like, oh, I just want to throw them out the window. And the person with OCD says, I think I want to throw them out the window.
Yeah. Exactly. It's just a release of your anger, which doesn't mean you love them any less. It just means you're human and you're pushed to your absolute limit. You're gonna feel these feelings. And of course, society doesn't allow you to own them. Society makes it taboo, right?
I would say probably I would make it even more individual than that. I think it's about something in your family and how relationships worked in your family and how those emotional dynamics played out in your family made it unacceptable.
Yeah. Okay.
Society could also layer on top of that, but I think it starts in the family. That's also like, you know, people make fun of psychoanalysis and say, oh, it's all about your mother. But like, really what we're saying is no, like your patterns and relationships are based on the experiences you've had in relationships. Happens to be your first relationship was with your parents.
Hmm.
And in many cases with your mother.
Yep. True. Then your siblings. And then,
you took those dynamics and those expectations and those patterns and played them out with siblings and then played them out at school. And all those experiences changed and rejiggered those dynamics a little bit, but they're still built on earlier dynamics.
True. But I think I have probably one, I'll call it a challenge. It's not a challenge. I think I need to understand it better. And I think, so I guess my challenge is, that's a good example. And I can see how that works. But let's say paedophile OCD, right? So I'm worried about being a paedophile, let's say, because here we're talking about it's symbolic, but then here it sounds like it is still symbolic, but also the intrusive thought is very much linked to the reality of my child is pushing me to my limits and I'm really annoyed and I can't express it.
So what could POCD be about?
Yeah. Is that just 100% symbolic and it has not see anything to do with the content, obviously, but it's...
I'll give you a couple of examples, okay? Please. And I want to be very clear to listeners, like psychoanalysis is very much centers individual experience and not knowing and finding out and not like sort of making assumptions. It's not like, in contrast to like exposure response prevention, where we're like, you have OCD, here is what we do. It is the same for everyone, at least in certain, on a certain level. Psychoanalysis is very much about individual experience, but I'll give some examples of dynamics that could be involved in POCD. We're not saying this is everybody or every case, but a simple formulation for some people, or part of a formulation, might be that, let's say you're someone who grows up with sexual feelings being unacceptable for one reason or another, not pedophilic sexual feelings, just sexual feelings in general, whether that is because, let's say, a person, and again, don't get sure, I'm just giving an example, listeners who are like, you know, everybody with OCD is listening for proof that their OCD is real, but where that's not happening, and keep that in mind. Okay, so let's say somebody grows up gay in a family or a society where that's not acceptable. And they're, for a good part of their lives, constantly scared by any sexual feelings that they have, or constantly worried about there being something wrong with them sexually. So let's say they would have a conflict, let's say, between their normal, healthy sexual feelings and wishes and the prospect of shame or being rejected, or again, threat to attachment in some way. So maybe they grow up and they learn more and they find out that, let's say this is someone who is like fine being gay now, totally comes to terms with it. They're totally cool with it. Their family's accepting. Everything's fine. Okay. On an emotional level, though, maybe this is someone who continues to have... continues to constantly be monitoring any sexual feelings and maybe has feelings of shame around sexuality or feelings of fear about being rejected for sexual feelings that don't go away just because you come out of the closet. And so maybe those feelings that aren't, they don't really make sense anymore rationally because, you know, intellectually, the person's like, I'm fine with being gay. I'm fine with my sexual feelings. But let's say they spent 15 years or 10 years or 25 years not being okay with those sexual feelings. Maybe now that unconscious concern that sexual feelings lead to shame and rejection might get captured symbolically by a preoccupation with pedophilic feelings. What if I'm a pedophile? Right. And again, to be clear, we're not saying the person is a pedophile, but we're saying maybe that's a topic that is where those feelings get expressed. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So sorry, I'm myself muted there. The pedophilic intrusive thought is a shameful one. And if they've been made to feel ashamed of their perfectly normal, healthy sex drive, whatever that is, homosexual, heterosexual, whatever, it's the pedophilic shameful taboo stuff is just symbolic for the shame that they were made to feel about their normal.
Yeah. Just as an example of what, of something, or let's say another example might be, suffice to say, there could be other reasons besides being gay that a person might be made to feel like sexual feelings were shameful. And that
I could give an example. If we think about a really hyper religious family where sex is only for the marriage, and even when you get married, it's very vanilla and you keep it, you know, honorable with God. And not there's anything wrong with vanilla sex, but you know what I mean? Then if someone starts to feel that they have a high libido or they're really interested, even if it's heterosexual or whatever, but sex is such a taboo, shameful topic in any variety, then that's another example.
Yeah. Or even if they don't have a high libido, even if they're just a person and they have normal, you know, they just have sexual feelings sort of acknowledging our asexual friends out there. But if most, you know, for people who are sexual, they don't have to be hypersexual to have concerns about this. Or let's say this is a person who grew up, as somebody gay who has many gay friends, like, you grow up like totally hyper focused on what you're feeling and what it means. And that doesn't just go away because you come out.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Okay, so a question I have then is everyone with OCD? If we take this, if Malin's triangles and Malin's model and the psychodynamic thinking around OCD, is everyone just have been unable to feel their emotions? Is there some case of OCD where you feel the psychodynamic side, in this case, this theory, isn't at play? If that makes sense?
When you put it that broadly, like, does everybody with OCD have like conflicts around certain feelings that are manifesting as their symptoms? When you put it that broadly, I think we can safely say yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think from an analytic perspective, you could say that about all psychopathology, not just OCD. Also, just sort of broadening it here, I think Bion, another famous analytic figure, I think he talked about how like none of us can really tolerate feeling everything that we would feel. Like, there is a limit to how much we can tolerate feeling. And so all of us have defenses. Defenses are not... people with a mental health issue are not the only people with defenses. Everybody has defenses. That's an important part of being, you know, functioning human, not functioning. Everybody's defending all the time. So it's not even just people with OCD who are defending against painful or overwhelming feelings. It's everybody.
Yeah. 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 100%.
You're saying, can we apply this to everyone? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. Good.
There are so few things that you can like say that black and white, but when you put it that broadly, I think the answer is yes. Also, I'll take this opportunity to say, anybody listening who's like, Greenberg is saying we should do psychoanalysis instead of CBT. I am not saying that. I 100% endorse ERP. I think people with OCD need ERP. And moreover, something I didn't say about Malin is that Malin writes about the psychodynamic formulation of OCD, but then in his book, in two separate places, he owns that psychoanalysis is not an effective treatment for OCD. He says that. And he says the behaviorists are better at treating these symptoms, but they have no idea what's really going on here. We have a better sense of what's going on here, but it doesn't do anything for the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And he says what we need one day is a treatment that integrates both an understanding of what's happening here and also a behavioral treatment. So I am not saying that we should replace, Malin is not saying, and I am not saying that we should replace ERP with psychoanalysis. I'm saying that we should enhance ERP with the added perspective and added understanding and added tools that psychoanalysis or psychodynamic treatment, again, using those interchangeably, can give us. So that when we're treating a kid who comes in and, you know, whatever, when we're a kid who comes in and dad is contaminated and he doesn't want to touch dad, he doesn't want to touch anything dad touched, if you're just a behaviorist, then you just do exposures to touching dad and touching things that dad has touched. And if you're thinking a little bit more psychodynamically, or hope, I mean, if you're thinking, then you would ask, well, you know, what's going on here between this kid and their dad? You know, what's going on an emotional and relational level? And you wouldn't just do, you know, exposures. So that's what I'm saying. You still do the exposures, but you understand, like, what is this really about? Or for just as one other example, like, in my experience, many, if not all, contamination cases seem to relate to boundaries and feeling like your boundaries are being violated in some way, whether that is physically, whether that's in terms of privacy, even if that's like emotional, feeling like somebody is scrutinizing you and you don't have sort of an emotional boundary, whether that's sexually, whatever, boundaries, very broadly speaking. So in a lot of contamination cases, a lot of the work is not just about contamination or exposures to contamination. It's also about recognizing those dynamics and working on the issues around boundaries, whether that's being able to set boundaries, even though maybe in your family that was unacceptable. Maybe if you're working with, this is very important also when you're working with families, because when you're working with kids, these dynamics are probably still happening right now. And so part of working, it's not just doing ERP with the kid, it's also addressing the dynamics that are going on in the family that are contributing to these symptoms, not just them to people, behaviorists, when some people who have been in my trainings, they want to take psychoanalytic concepts and put them into behavioral terms. Oh, you're talking about reinforcement. Oh, you're talking about accommodation. It's like, no, you cannot boil all psychoanalytic ideas. Psychoanalysis is a world unto itself with volumes and volumes of writing and theory, and it's its own world. And you can't just map it all onto cognitive behavioral terms. So just as a sidebar, but when you're working with families, understanding what's going on emotionally and what's going on relationally in the family is an extremely important dimension to treating the kid. And it can also address things on a deeper level than just addressing the behavior. The way I would think about it nowadays is CBT, and I'm not knocking CBT. It's really important and really important for people with OCD. And I would by all means start with ERP, but it's kind of like weed whacking, you know, clearing the field, which is not, the importance of that is not to be minimized. But then you have to figure out, why is this a field where these things grow? You know, what we have to go for the roots of, like, where are these symptoms coming from in the first place? You know, if we have a mom who is very controlling, but then if you get upset at her, she cries, right? And so you can't be upset. Or if you get upset at her, it's just like, fine, I won't take care of you. You don't want my help? Fine. And so I'm not even conscious of how controlled I feel. And that comes out in terms of like intrusive thoughts of killing mom or whatever it might be. So just doing exposures or stopping rumination around killing mom is really important. But then you probably also need to address these dynamics around control, you know, and around how mom responds to anger, for example.
Yeah, really good point. I like your analogy or metaphor. The two confuse me, but as in analogy and metaphor. It's one of those things, no matter how many times I read up the difference between the two, it never sticks in my head. That's a whole separate issue. But I look at it as like a fire. So CBT or ERP or ACT or whatever, I know is about getting the flames down, right? The symptoms down. And then you've got to work on the embers, because otherwise that fire will ignite again.
I'm with you on that. Yeah. And I think I'll acknowledge here that there's a, for anybody who's heard me talk about the psychoanalytic perspective in the past, since the articles came out, I talk about this every time, because it's real to me. So I just apologize if this is repetitive for anyone, but there's a psychoanalytic concept of omnipotent fantasy. An omnipotent fantasy is a fantasy that if only I do X, Y, or Z just right, I can exert control over A, B, or C, where A, B, or C are something that I feel helpless about. So examples of omnipotent fantasy are, if I eat exactly the right diet, I can cure my medical condition. Or if only I pray enough, I can prevent this person from dying. Or if only I behave well enough, I can prevent my fill in the blank alcoholic, borderline, whatever, volatile parent from being volatile. I can, you know, keep them stable. And I think that my relationship to ERP a few years ago was an omnipotent fantasy. I think it was a fantasy that if only I could get ERP exactly right, if only I could perfect this thing, that it would be the be all end all answer to OCD. And if we just got it exactly right, we could cure. Not that I ever use that word, but I think emotionally, that's what I was hoping. OCD. And I think that through my own analysis, like being in analysis and also learning more, and also I think working with, I work with a lot of patients over several years, I think I've come to terms with the fact that for myself and my patients, it's unfortunately much more complicated than that. And that's not to minimize like the importance of ERP. And also I totally endorse rumination-focused ERP. I still stand by that. I think that learning how to not ruminate, if you don't know how to do that, is life-changing, and that people can have a tremendous improvement in symptoms, a tremendous improvement in how they feel through not ruminating. So I endorse all of that. But I think that whereas I used to see that as like the whole picture, now I think that there's unfortunately a lot more to it. I say unfortunately because I, along with the rest of the obsessive compulsives, we want quick fixes and we want clear answers and we want like things that we can do ourselves. To say that there's more complexity here, that you might need help from different people, you know, that it might be a process, is not something that any of the obsessive compulsives wants to hear, at least in my experience.
Yeah, fair point. I did the usual stuff for OCD, and I obviously still use all those skills to this day. But I've done many years of working with a therapist who isn't CBT trained in any way, and much more relational, much more talking about the other things that were maybe in my past. And I'm not saying necessarily everyone needs to go back to their past, although. But for me, that I did, and that's been really helpful to me as a human being. Forgetting OCD for a second,
me too. Yeah, and I think that's something. What's something so interesting about analysis is that like it's not linear, and it's not like what I mean. I would also say to anybody who's listening to this and has not been in analysis and thinks they know what analysis looks like, trust me, you don't. It's not remotely like what I thought it was going to be. Like I thought it was going to be, you come in and they tell you like, you're doing this because of this, and this is because of that. And like, that's not at all what it looks like. It's not even always necessarily diving into your past. A lot of it is in the present and clarifying your feelings about things, feelings that are not being acknowledged, relational dynamics that you're not conscious of. I lost my train of thought. What are we talking about?
Yeah. Well, it was just your experience of psychoanalysis.
Yeah. Something else, going back to the, if I may, going back to the omnipotent fantasy thing, there's another analogy that, or metaphor, that I've been using to, that is meaningful to me in thinking about like ERP and versus the rest of this picture. And that is, so again, I've used this in other conversations. If you have somebody who is I don't know what the correct way to say this is, but overweight, right? Or heavier than they want to be, okay? Because they overeat. And I'm not saying that everybody who's overweight, that it is because they overeat, but let's say we have someone where that is the case. It is true that that person, that in quotes, all they have to do to lose weight is to eat less. That's all they have to do. So technically that's true, but that's also like a ridiculous thing to say, because clearly it's so much more complicated than that. And clearly there are also questions about what drives them to eat and why, you know, why they're doing that and et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that that's, at least as far as I've thought about it, I think that's a good analogy for the integration of ERP and analysis. Yeah. Like, I think it's true that if a person stops ruminating consistently all the time, they can really get their symptoms down, or get their anxiety down. But at the same time, like, that's like saying, well, you know, if you just ate less, you wouldn't be overweight. And we need to understand, you know, what's driving that rumination? Where does the impulse come from to do that? Not to mention that we can maybe like attenuate the drive to ruminate, weaken that, or take the power out of it. That's not the right word. Like, lessen the drive by sorting through the emotional dynamics that are driving it in the first place. And so that's, if we had someone who didn't know that they could control what they put in their mouth, literally didn't know that technically on a technical level it was possible to make choices about what they eat, it would be life-changing to teach them that they can do that. And I think that that is teaching somebody how to stop ruminating. It is life-changing. People with OCD, we don't know how much control we have over what's going on in our minds. We don't realize it's something that we can control. And teaching somebody that they can control it and how to control it and showing them that they feel immeasurably better when they control it, that's life-changing and massively important. Yeah. And I'm not minimizing that. But then the question is, you know, just telling them you can control what goes in your mouth, and if you eat less, you'll lose weight, is both technically true and also leaves out a huge amount of the picture of what else is going on.
100%. And it's always been about integration for me. My training was integrative. I use Mallin's triangles as part of my formulation for every client I work with, as well as CBT formulations and other formulations from different therapies, including compassion-focused therapy. Because it's, you've got to look at it from so many angles to understand it. You can't just come in with one view. Yeah, so I'm glad Mallin said that and you're saying that. So I'm going to ask you one more question, if that's okay. Yeah. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So slight detour now, but this is from another one of your new articles. So I want to read, I pretty much copied almost a paragraph, so I just want to read that. Whenever you find it difficult to stop ruminating, the first question to ask yourself is always, how am I justifying the fact that I am ruminating right now? Since rumination is always analytical thinking, and analytical thinking always requires effort, you can't ruminate unless there's a part of you that is doing it on purpose, though there's obviously a part of you that also desperately trying to stop. In order to stop, you need to take a look at the reason that the part of you is making the choice to ruminate. So I guess I just wanted to briefly, I know this is a whole article you wrote and I'll link to it.
I also, this is an old article.
Okay, that's fine, my bad.
Yeah, so anybody who's reading my website, like, some of these are so like polished and some of these are so janky, like, just please be aware, I know. And like, I do intend to go back and revise. Yeah. So that article is probably from like 5 years ago.
All right. Fair enough. So it's so old or new. It stood out to me, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think I've had people ask me questions for you in particular, like, how do you do, RFERP with really stubborn intrusive thoughts, or I've done it and they keep coming. And I felt this article and this question of how am I justifying the fact that I'm ruminating right now, I think is an important one. And maybe I just wanted you to speak about it a bit.
Yeah. I think when we're dealing with rumination, we can have we can address it on three levels. We can address it on a technical level. Does a person know how to stop ruminating? Do they really know how? What's their understanding of what that means? How are they trying to do it? For example, is somebody trying to actively distract themselves? That's not going to work. Is somebody trying to push away thoughts? That's not going to work. So we can have issues on a technical level. Then we can have somebody who they've done how to stop ruminating. They get it. They know how to do it, but they're having trouble doing it in general. And there we can address things on the level of justification. And justification is like, on the one hand, I don't want to think about this, but on the other hand, I need to figure this out, or maybe this is really important, or maybe I do need to come to terms with this, or whatever the justification might be. And as long as a person is not making a clear decision to stop, or as long as you're trying to do both, I want to stop, but also I need to figure this out, they're not going to be able to stop. They need to make a clear decision. That doesn't mean that they need to have an answer to that. It means at the end of the day, like, you either do it or you don't do it. You can have mixed feelings about it. You can have mixed feelings about eating the cookie, but at the end of the day, either you eat it or you don't. And then we can also address things on an emotional level. In other words, what's really driving this? I think this is on a technical level. This is like, either you eat it or you don't, right? Like, you're saying, oh, I don't want to eat the cookie, but look, it's in my mouth, right? Oh, but I don't want, oh, here I am, but I don't want to. That's like, either you do or you don't. You can't hold the ball and drop it at the same time. You need to sort out your conflict. You need to recognize that you're trying to do both things. You need to make a decision. Are you doing it or not doing it? And then you need to make a clear decision to stop. And I think that people can do that. And it's not that simple. And I spend a lot of time or a good chunk of treatment looking at, what are the emotional factors that are going on here? What's the context to this rumination? Why are you ruminating right now? Maybe what is this moving you away from? Maybe what is this capturing that's not being acknowledged? Maybe what's underneath this? Like, for example, we don't have that much time. Okay. In the interest of time, I'll say, on the website, I did just publish an article that's part of the new articles called Anatomical Models of OCD. And that maps out some examples of how you might conceptualize the emotional dynamics that are driving rumination or that are within rumination. Those are just examples, but they're good examples of how you could address this on an emotional level. So I think it's true that a person can always stop ruminating technically, and that if a person makes a clear decision to stop in a given moment, they can stop and they can lower their anxiety that way. And I think that while that's completely true, that's not a total treatment. And we also need to address what's really going on here on an emotional level, and why they're ruminating, and what this is really about, and what their worldview consciously and unconsciously is. And sort through those dynamics. Is that an answer to the question you were asking?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that. So look, this conversation has been really fascinating. Obviously we could have gone into a ton of depth, or that I think we did, but you know, that we could have gone on for hours. So lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said on this topic today?
Like I said, I came in, like, I know I do better when I don't have an outline and I don't have talking points. So I came in just without any of that. But that also means probably I didn't say things or say everything in the clearest possible way. I spent a lot of time, like a tremendous amount of time, polishing up my clearest version of these ideas in the articles. So anybody who's listening to this and they're like, want more information or didn't completely understand or have questions, I would encourage you to just read the articles that are available on the website. Specifically, there's not a list. I'll just name them. Can I name them?
Yep.
Okay. I'm naming these because I don't have unless you're on the email list for the website, you won't know which the new ones are. Okay. The new articles that talk about this analytic stuff and the integrative stuff are Mallon's Model of OCD, that talks about Mallon and the triangle of conflict and healthy aggression. Then there's three types of OCD cases, integrating Mallon's Model of OCD with the core fear model. And that talks about how the two models fit together, which we alluded to. There's anatomical models of rumination, which talks about different ways of looking at the emotional dynamics involved in rumination. Again, just a few, it's not the whole picture. Causal justifications is a new one that we didn't talk about. And then two other articles that are not analytic, but are just new, if anybody's interested, are defining and demarcating compulsion, that talks about conceptualizing compulsion in terms of what a person does and does not want to do, as opposed to some objective standard. And lastly, RFERP order of operations. This is like not an article, it's a step-by-step like guide through all the steps of RFERP for anybody who wants to use it, a therapist or patient, to like anybody who's looking for like the step-by-step of what this treatment looks like, that's available.
Nice. Great. I'll link to all of those in the show notes. So look, thank you so much for coming on, as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to see you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast.
And thank you to JS Health. And if you would like to get 15% off their entire range, head to jshealthvitamins.com and use the code OCDstories at the checkout. The link will be in the episode description.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.